Philosophy 10, May 14th, 1954.
The meeting's left, if you close the door. And, I want to take you today into the cycle of universal science which will lie beyond the natural science cycle. And the next 2 weeks, however, I wish to devote to something more personal. I wish to take you, to confront you with the people who made these cycles work. We go back and talk of the people in the theological, in the philosophical, and in the sociological cycle as persons. I have these 2 weeks, and I think something can be done to show you how colorful life is when you enter upon the army of thought and enlist there, even just as supporters or interested parties. Today I would like you to listen first to a letter. If you listen to it, it's a very crude letter, if you will see. You will understand why we today are in a profound crisis, because treating man and treating the gods as part of nature has landed us in concentration camps. So the dealing with things that do not speak to us, but which have just to be measured and weighed, is not leading us anymore into any future. The cycle of the natural sciences, as we shall see in a minute, is closed. The best you can hope for is Mr. Einstein. And Einstein has nothing to do to say except that everything is relative, which we knew beforehand. But your problem is obviously to decide things and to say if they are not relative. And in this moment, you get out of hand. And the natural scientist himself either goes into a monastery or gets before the loyalty board. Suddenly he's in trouble. And since he is in trouble and his science is in trouble, you cannot wonder that I got the following letter. Dear Professor, I expect you will not remember my name. I do. You took a course with me. It comes from Orléans, France. I write you now to ask you if you could tell me what you meant when you said in class, do not die in the army. And most Americans are dead by 25. Respectfully yours, Kennedy Wood. Now, it's quite a letter. I hope you will write it one day too, but a little more friendly, introducing, giving a little more background. You cannot answer a letter which just says, I write you now to ask you if you could tell me what you meant when you said in class, do not die in the army and most Americans are dead by 25. So I do not know if I can answer the letter by letter, but allow me to answer his questions before you. He means to say that I hinted at the fact that men under the modern tenets of life is an object of science, and all objects of science are killed in the process, because what is said about them in books or in science or in analysis or in statistics or in the famous mark that everybody now gets when he's born is, you know, Arkansas number 0001 for the first child born in Arkansas and so on. Fingerprint being fingerprinted, being labeled. Once you begin to think that the label attached to a person from the outside is more true than what he expects you to think about him tomorrow, you have given up the living triangle, remember, in which all people move, and you have buried. Now, most of you are quite willing to say that you are to be classified, that the day will come when psychology will know who you are, who man is. That's the great hope under which you live, that somebody else at some one time will know more about man than you know. As soon as you admit this, you are dead. Because you expect to be known by somebody else better than you know yourself, without having any court of appeal by which you could force him to think differently of you. When a man tells me, I know you, the only answer is either to fall in love with him or to slap him in the face. There's no other solution. You have to do something about breaking down his idea that he knows you, because that means that you're dead. To be fully known is the moment of death. And I told you, remember in the beginning of this course, that we must only be known on our deathbed. Or when if husband and wife know each other, then that's possible under the condition that from now on they live together and become an impenetrable secret to the rest of the world. Because after having come to know each other, they form a womb of time, a body politic, a unity, and so they can go on from there and become something totally unexpected and new. I know one couple who is a scholar and has a very famous professorship, and she said to me the other day, of course I write his books, he only gives the break, puts on the brakes. Now that's a good marriage. Nobody knows this. He is a professor and she writes the books. That's some such secret, you know, as it prevails in any good household. That nobody outside really knows who does what. I'm quite serious, gentlemen. In the middle of life we die. If in our marriage we cannot interpenetrate so to such an extent that we two together do something that didn't exist for A and for B. But with modern psychoanalysis and psychology, and with conflicts in the marriage and so on, and with a woman working outside, that's impossible. She's interpenetrated. She has to be herself, and he has to be herself. So she remains two selves, and of course they are bored stiff after a certain time, because the self is the most uninteresting unit in the world. A man is only interesting if he can absorb and coalesce with other people and represent them. A man who is elected to Congress becomes more interesting for this reason, because he has to absorb the opinions of his constituency, and in representing them, he is bigger than he was before. Any teacher who has real students is much bigger than he was before, because his students make him think. And he is suddenly inflated. He's 10 times as large as he would be otherwise. But you don't think so, gentlemen. You are a natural scientist, only in the ovation pocket, but you are. And you believe that everybody is himself. Although the Bible and although every good poem tells you that this is nonsense, that the self is dead, that anybody who tries to save his soul will lose it. You think that's just poetry or sentimentality, and you don't have to heed this at all, and you think, if I only knew. And so you go for 4 years to the analyst, and he finally tells you that you are dead, which you knew anyway. And there you are. And dirt belongs to the dung heap. That's where you are placed, and so most Americans are dead by 25. Or, do not die in the army, that's some other behavior, gentlemen. That's not quite the same. In the army, many of you, and of people in my generation too, try to put on an oil skin and to say, if I only can last these 2 years, and you are not there, and you put yourself on ice, and you say, during these 2 years, I'm not responsible. Oh, there's a corporal, there's a sergeant, there's a master sergeant. These damn people put me through the ropes, and so it doesn't matter what I'm doing if I can only last in boot camp. And so you write off the most precious experience of your life as not your experience, but it's the army's experience with you, and it's a very sad experience. And because you aren't there. And I know so many of you who really think the drive consists in being not there. Not quite there. Waiting until you are out of it again, and then you begin to live again. Isn't that true? Wouldn't you agree that most of you think of getting by in the army? The whole purpose of this year? If you do this, gentlemen, you get all the terrible things that have happened in the army in the last year. In the last years, you know this book, The Naked and the Dead. That is, a man who isn't there will run down the morale of the army. He's not responsible. If they are dead to be buried, he will not bury them. If they are prisoners to be shot, he will have shot through them. That is, he will say, the war is so bad, the army is so bad, that doesn't matter very much. He will not instill into this army his whole being, because from the very beginning he's three quarters out of it. The most miserable soldiers are the pacifists, because they say that war is so bad and so wicked that it doesn't make much difference. People are shot, so why not shoot a prisoner? Take the men. A man who shoots the enemy in action is a hero. And the man who allows that in the naked and the dead, that a prisoner is shot just for fun, is a swine and can never come to life again before he has a public repentance. And that this book can be written without consequence in this country is just horrible. Countries with a military tradition just wouldn't stand for this, that this author doesn't chastise himself, so to speak, for having stood by and not doing anything. But this country, you see, as you all know, is split. You live a civilian life and you don't live in the army, so you are dead in the army. Because the army wants to be a noble. The army cannot live except by the deans or by the wainwrights. The people who are there and who make the war then different from what it be otherwise. Just hear what some noble Japanese did to our soldiers, coming out with their Christian faith and alleviating their task under the most trying circumstances. I know such cases. And that is by which humanity lives, gentlemen. Life is always miserable. This class is too. I could put you to sleep. You could die in this class. I've been responsible to cry you away. Isn't there a difference between just teaching by rote and teaching with the idea that perhaps even a classroom could come to life? Now, it would be just as bad if I and you treated this classroom as something which has just to be gotten by and gone through as you do in the office. Exactly the same nonsense. The life that you live, gentlemen, you have only received once. There's not a minute of this life that you can say, I'm not there. The more you do this, gentlemen, the more impotent you take this. And that's why many people in this country are dead by 25, because from then on they leave religion, the arts, etc., and society to their wives. And so in part at least they die because they say, we have a women's club in town, that's for civilization. So wherever you look, gentlemen, whenever you think these two things, that there is a way of not being there, and that there is a way in which others in the end, after all, are in charge of research and science, and so they'll know you and your ailments. You have lost your own freedom, your own existence, your own reality, and your whole soul. Because the soul is that irreplaceable one thing of yours which marches on. After they slaughter you, after they torture you, after they analyze you, after they command you to die in an attack, you stay there. But only under the conditions that you say, this moment is irreplaceable and I'm indispensable. As you know, the slogan of the American boy is, I'm just a human being, by which he politely says that he is just a louse. If you are a human being, gentlemen, it's irreplaceable. A louse is not. A louse, he can be limited. A human being, you cannot. He has one irreplaceable place. He is being called today by his name and is expected to do the one thing nobody else does. For For example, when a prisoner is in danger of being shot, although he has surrendered, it is this one soul's business to jump up and hit the captain over the head or shoot the captain and say, this prisoner is under my care. Who has read this book, The Naked Emperor?
Well, it's so obscene that of course you have read.
Yes, sir.
Sir, this soul, is there any other basis for it other than religion? This idea of the soul, is there any other basis for it other than religion?
There's no basis for religion.
In religion for the soul. The basis for religion is in the soul, but there is no basis for the soul in religion.
It's all nonsense.
You know as much of the soul of all organized religion put together. You don't depend on religion for your soul, sir. You see? But religion depends on your soul. It's the other way around, isn't it? Because we have a soul, we tolerate these mini-special reminders occasionally that we have one. Otherwise you wouldn't tolerate these people, you see. But you know in your brighter moments that we forget certain things, you see. Religion is the machinery to bring everybody up short to his senses, that's all. Because you know that you mostly are not up to your own occasion. But everything you know about your own life, you know yourself, sir. You know much better than anybody else. No, the religion is the garment. If you hadn't a body with a soul, you see, you couldn't put on this garment. Now, nobody, gentlemen, before 1850 would have been able to ask these two questions. What do you mean by saying do not die in the army and most Americans are dead by 25? Nobody. Because people down to that time still knew that they had a share in the divine, the everlasting, the eternal life. You need not call this soul, sir, if you are nervous about soul, you see. But you knew very well that you could speak with authority, for example, to your children. You see, to modern man doesn't know that any mother and any father are gods to their children. They've been forbidden to talk to them. That's all given to the psychologists. So they do not say anything. But any mother who says to her child, let's pray, is God and goddess. And so God is a daily experience for any man before our age, through the ages. With regard to your children, you are God. You like it or not, you can be the devil by telling them, I can't tell you. It's your damn duty to tell these children. And of course, if you say, I don't know, then you put them into hell. Because why did you live if you aren't there to try and convey to them what can be known? So today, gentlemen, you are things. Because I told you, a thing is the reality without speech. And I told you that's nature. And I tried to make you understand that the word nature is already minus the whole of reality. If I treat you as nature, gentlemen, you are a person, as I said about this classroom, without a past and without a future. You are called here by the slogan Philosophy 10, so you haven't heard anything while you are here, you just have gone astray, you're sitting here as bodies, and you don't know from here where my words will carry you. And they won't carry you anywhere, then you are nature. But you will know very well that you are not nature. You came here for a good reason, to show off for your girl. And you came here also with some faint expectation that there might be something to carry away. In this very moment, you are, as we said, you form a womb of time. There is something that is not visible at this moment, and something that is not visible it was not visible in the past, is going to come true one day. And that's why you go to darkness, in expectation. And that's why you go to this course, in hope. And if the hope comes true, you have formed something that is against all nature, because you have formed the womb of time has formed around you, gentlemen. And you have lived through some history, or as people today like to call it, some biography. I've written a book which is called Autobiography of Western Man, in which I've tried to show that man has no natural history, but an autobiography, which is something quite different. Because the autobiography, he's held in a language which is all his own. And the natural history of man is told without his having to listen and to agree with it. If you take the so-called scientific history of America today, it is written in such a way that not one of the Pilgrim Fathers and not one of the Founding Fathers would have to agree with it. For example, Huey Charles Byrd would say, George Washington would say, but that's not me. He says, I'm just a landowner, and I was the richest man in town, and so I wrote this constitution. That's infamous. I never gave it a thought. I wanted to save this country from tyranny and from George III. But the scientific historian says, that's not my business. I don't know what you have to say. I don't listen to you. I listen to the facts. Now, such a history, you see, is a scientific history in the sense of the 19th century, and that is a natural history. But my and your history is the story which you can recognize when you are told the story by your friend. And he said, yes, that's possible. So, gentlemen, in history, the people who have lived the history must agree. They must find themselves in agreement with the historian, or it cannot be their history. But in natural history, what do people tell about fishes and lions? These poor lions, they're never asked. I'm sure they would complain. So we get, gentlemen, three stories, three cycles. The Middle Ages get buried with the gods, and so they buried with the pyramid and the courts and how do you call the place on which the person is operated? Yes, operation table. Any better word? No one single word on the operation table? And anybody who has been under the knife of a surgeon knows that at that moment he is helpless. And anybody who has gone to court knows he's helpless, because in a court you don't know the law's delay. You formally the suits on inheritance possibly could go on for 20, 30 years. So if anybody who goes and gives a little finger to a lawyer, you see, is suddenly under the majesty of a time, of a calendar, which is quite out of his reach. Look at the hearings of Mr. McCarthy. We would like to end them now. But they are the ends of the devil. You see? And that is demonic. And that is the wrong court. That is the miscarriage of justice. Because the people in this court have no longer control over the length of time they have to give to this nonsense instead of their imprisonment. So, gentlemen, today still the gods take care of you when you go to this divine service. And the people can put point with their fingers to you and say he is one of the superstitious people who goes to church. Because you are willing to suffer for your confession of faith. In the courts, you are willing to suffer for your litigation, to stay in the clutches of the law as long as the lawyers say they must. And on the operation table, I need not tell you that it is suddenly you have abdicated your own will and you have taken upon yourself a higher will who decides what to do with it. Now, and we said also, gentlemen, that this was established in a such a way in the Middle Ages that all lawyers, all judges, and all preachers or father confessors became aware of their tremendous responsibility and from being mere magicians turned into free agents who knew that at any one moment they had to be reborn as preachers, as doctors, as lawyers. You remember the right of resistance, and you remember the rules for epidemics, and you remember the discussion on the universals. That is, any one theologian learned that at any one hour in the life of his parish, some other taboo might be declared to be just a wrong universal, a dead universal, a mere empty name, a nominalist, you see, had to become, in respect to mere things that didn't care a lot. And yet he become a realist with regard to those authorities which his parishioners still had to need. And with a lawyer, you remember, just laws must be obeyed, unjust laws may be disobeyed, you see, or they must be disobeyed. You see how the lawyer at every 1 minute of history had to waken up to this question. Was the law that he taught just? And so he had to bring in his own conscience. And you can say, gentlemen, that from the Middle Ages we have inherited the conscience of the professional man. Because in this conscience he became divine. And he could no longer hand over some real religion, as you think, sir, as a dead matter that doesn't exist. If you and I at this moment do not recreate our faith, you see, there is no such thing. It's an eternal, you see, a perpetual creation, religion, or it isn't. There is nobody who can tell you if you don't tell yourself. But we saw that the professional people in the Middle Ages, the people with responsibility for other people, we became aware of their tremendous duty to turn against mere magic, as we may call it, or mere tradition, or mere paper, or mere words. And that in every one moment, they had to know that they were in a position of course. I told you the Supreme Court must know this so that they can rise beyond their elders, these judges, these old men, and not become impatient with a client who doesn't make a good impression. That was Mr. Douglas' impression when the Rosenberg case came before him, that whether he liked them or not, that there wasn't the place, they had to get one more hearing. And I think that courage shows you what it means to be a justice. He made himself perfectly most unpopular and perhaps finished his opportunity of being candidate for the presidency of the United States. Now, amen, this certainly is his case. And that was his Justice Douglas. And that comes from the Middle Ages. And that comes from the old university tradition. So, gentlemen, from the Middle Ages, we have inherited the conscience of the professional man. And you have the greatest fruit of the medieval university is Mr. Einstein or Mr. Planck or all the scientists. Why is Mr. Oppenheimer now under examination? Not because he is a physicist, gentlemen, but because he is a good physicist, a good man from the Middle Ages. He has a soul, he has a conscience, and that's held against him. He has a man with a biography. He has changed. And that's held against him. But as a living being, as a professional man, he has to have this conscience and he has to have this biography. Otherwise, he would just be a technician, a plumber. And that's what you think a scientist should be, a plumber. But he isn't. You always mistake, as you know, applied science and real science. But real science is exciting. And it takes a whole man into the dark. And I always demand from him a break with the past and a new act of freedom. Remember, we have said all these things before. So, gentlemen, the new world of 1500 to 1900 then consists of two things. An inheritance from the Middle Ages are the scientists, as educated people, formed in universities and in liberal arts colleges, and being real humans because they are free and have a soul, sir. And the other thing is that they have looked into the universe of things, of dead matter. And have prepared and reported all the facts on this in the academic world to the files and stacks of our libraries and our laboratories and of our statistical bureaus. Now, gentlemen, from now on, to whatever you date the length of time that man is given on this planet, obviously this question of Mr. Woody exists. Most Americans are dead by 25 or do not die in the army. That is, the objects of the scientific analysis, you and I, the customers of the psychoanalyst, the client of the lawyer, the objects of statistics, we have the right not to be just dead and to come to peace, to terms with our torturers, and to get out of the concentration camps or out of marriage for hospital as free men, and not treating us from now on as just cases of the man who has treated us, or judged us, or analyzed us. He cannot know more than you do. That's the whole slogan today. That's your problem. That you still think he has the faintest idea of who I am. And whatever he says, it's quite different from what I know about myself. I have brought it down to a very simple formula, gentlemen, but I want now to be more specific. These words, you still are a great lover of nature. And so let's begin from where we are. You live in the 19th century. Most Americans do. If you would live in the 20th century, you wouldn't have the Korean question. Because only geometry could divide Korea into two halves. That's natural science. Korea is a place on the map. You have a line there, the 38th degree of, you see, of latitude, and you put united people into two boxes, and that's called politics. Then that's natural science. You have done this to Germany, you have done this to Korea, now it's happening probably in Indochina. It is the victory of the natural scientific outlook on politics, you see. That from the outside you can divide what King Solomon avoided when the baby was brought to him, you remember, and both mothers claimed the baby. He said, divided by the sword. And then the woman who loved her own baby said, give it to the wrong mother, but let it live. And Sir King Solomon said, well, then you are the mother, because you didn't allow the child to be treated as a thing. Now, this we have to learn, gentlemen. We have treated Korea and Germany as things. And we are in the midst of, you have an imagination which is as dead as a dodo, because you think that you can compromise living units, and by division, by dividing it up, by taking a vote, and such nonsense.
Where do you think that this division of, say, Germany and Korea, the same sort of thing is limited to the 20th century?
Pardon?
Do you think that this, the division of countries like Germany and Korea is limited to the 20th century?
But it's certainly limited to people who go to school and learn wrong things about the universe. And the person who didn't go to school couldn't do such a thing. I mean, it is the literacy of you. You see, you people who go to too many schools and far too long. So that's the result of your wrong education. Wherever that happens, it can happen probably in other countries too. But it's only a mind that has lived by books and mathematics can do such nonsense. A selectman of a town could never do that, who had not never gone to school except 200 days for 7 years in a Vermont school here, certainly. No, sir. You see, Lincoln couldn't have done it. But Wilson might. He was president of the university. That's a very big preparation. Gentlemen, let's put the whole thing in a very simple manner. You will agree that all natural scientists deal with things either at rest or in motion. Now, the miraculous thing about nature is that, they do not deal with what these people, these things, these analyzed people say themselves, because that's not trusted. But what can be stated without my or your saying so about us? You see, that's scientific, that's objective. So, one thing, however, is necessary. Things in space move. And if you come to analyze the natural sciences, you could formulate the law of science in a very strange or simple manner both, which is usually not told you. Natural science has a hope to reduce all things to numbers, to curves, except movement. Movement has to be explained. As you know, the physicists have not been able to reduce waves to electrons or electrons to waves. They still debate what's earlier. And that's very significant, gentlemen. You and I, with our heartbeat and our breathing, we know what movement is. And movement cannot be proved. You cannot prove movement. You know the story of the hedgehog, hedgehog and his wife, when they ran the race, you see? And the lady hedgehog took her place at the goal and arrived earlier than the hare. You remember the story? You know this fable? What? Oh, you got it, the turtle. All right. Motion, you see, this is based on the assumption that who is the opponent, the hare, or who is it? Doesn't know what movement is. He has to run, you see, and so he is won over because he has the presence of mind to hold against the two turtles what movement is. Movement cannot be proved in natural science. Perhaps you take this down, very important. The natural scientist who tells you that he can prove everything by figures and mathematics is wrong. There's one experience, one a priori, as a philosopher calls it, one thing that you have to know before you understand anything in nature. What movement is it? Because you must describe the world of nature by gravity, for example. What it means to fall, you see, down, that you cannot prove to anybody who doesn't know what movement is. He just has to know it. Now, this may come as a startling fact to you, but it's very important that I have now tried to show to you that the people who deal with the gods, the people who deal with things, and now we who deal with humanity, have experiences in common which they cannot scientifically prove. But these three phrases of the three cycles of knowledge are of a different content. The physicist, gentlemen, who talks to the layman in a popular lecture about his findings, has one appeal to his customer that also the layman knows what movement is. He could not prove movement to the men to whom he gives a popular lecture. His ultimate appeal then is to a vital experience of his audience. The same is true when you come to the laboratory for the first time and are taken into the confidence of your professor, that he can rely on you already knowing what movement is. Movement we know as layman. Will you take this down? As layman, not as experts. So there is in all science something that is before science, which we call a priori. Before you can become a physicist, you must be a normal human being. This today is not true, because there are many scientists today who have tried hard to forget that they are also normal human beings, and they succeed. And then they say that very soon the brain will be substituted by machinery. That's the ultimate in devilry, as you know. That comes from people who have forgotten that they have still common sense before they become scientists. And you probably believe it too, that this childish Mr. Bina has a point in his no new science. He's just a fool. Because he doesn't know that he has to know something before he becomes a scientist. And I know the man, you see. His father sent him to Harvard when he was 14 years old, and so he has never become a normal human being, and he really thinks that he knows everything he knows as a scientist. He's a very poor soul, and you have to have pity with this child prodigy. His father, therefore. I knew the father, I know the son, and it's a great tragedy. But the terrible thing is in this country that you listen to such people who have been deprived of their normal upbringing. The second premise, gentlemen, the premise of the theologians, is a different one. It was brought out by the founder of the medieval cycle, by Anselm of Canterbury, and I postponed telling you this because perhaps only now can you know how important it is that the priests and the professional men also have something in common with the laity. The scientist must admit that he first must have his five senses and a sense of gravity outside his expert knowledge. That he is a normal layman before he's a scientist. The same is true of the Archbishop of Canterbury and of the great philosopher Abelard in the Middle Ages and of Thomas Aquinas and Bonaventura and of Luther and Melanchthon. They also have something, what we may call a universal layhood. Can you say layhood? No, layhood. You have heard so much about the universal priesthood which Luther preached. May I tell you that much more important at this moment is for you to understand that all scientists are ramifications of the universal laity, of the universal character of laymanship in all of us. Now, what is the laymanship, which is the presupposition of all medieval thought? Well, I don't have to formulate it, fortunately. Anselm of Canterbury has formulated himself. He said, I wish to prove by logical reasoning all things about God, all truth about God, except the incarnation, except the strange story of Jesus. He said, that cannot be proven by argument. That's just history. That's there. So the medieval university, and I have, so to speak, embedded this great truth to you so long in order to confront you with the same story about the natural sciences. The great theologians of the Middle Ages knew very well that unless the layman in all of us has some connection with the story of Bethlehem and the crucifixion in Jerusalem, the best cannot be proved. That there is a God, or that there is a first mover, you know, as Aristotle, that's not very interesting. In fact, it is very little. But if you illuminate the Aristotelian theology, or the Platonic theology, or the Old Testament theology, in the light of the life of Christ and the death of Christ, in the life of the early martyrs who went to the cross, or were burned at stake, or killed by the lions, when you first know the miracles, then you understand also the rational reasons for believing God. Now it's the opposite from what you believe. You live in such a strange Babylonian captivity of your mind, gentlemen, that you want to be in nature without being in the university. You want to be in an academy and you want to have your natural science, but you don't want to have the divine science. That is, you want to have science without the miracle of the scientist. But gentlemen, the medieval Anselm of Canterbury said, the miracle of being a man, of being free, we must learn from the saints. And then we can understand whence we are in partnership with this wonderful, free and miraculous life of these people on earth, what they meant by a merciful and just and creative and redeeming and revealing God. Before, it would be just a superstition and just words. So everything can be proven, gentlemen, except the contagious disease of your love of Christ. Love cannot be proven. It cannot. If you haven't experienced this, you go in vain to university. Totally in vain. Nobody can teach you anything about God in the true proportion. the men like Einstein or Oppenheimer, they have this love of the divine creative spirit, and therefore they understand what Aristotle said meant as a minimum about the prime mover. Otherwise, if you see God as a prime mover, you haven't said anything that's of any relevance to you or my life. But if you know that the flame that's burning in your heart is the same flame that created the universe and said, let there be light, then you suddenly say, well, I have a very noble pedigree. I'm a son of God. But only if you have this love of the incarnation, of this real story of your older brothers and your more miraculous ancestors. If you have no such respect, at least for the founding fathers or for Abraham Lincoln, who are all in this great pedigree, then you do not know what you're talking about when you begin at a bull session to argue the existence of God. And that's why your bull sessions are so empty, because you never dare to say, but I love Abraham Lincoln. And I'm identical with him. And that's the minimum which I know of the divine spirit. And then let's argue about the outside occasions at which this, the same divine spirit becomes known. So we have a second premise, gentlemen. The premise in theology is that nobody can be a good judge who doesn't believe that even in chains you can adjudicate in justice what is your client's or your plaintiff's right. The great medieval statement, gentlemen, on the freedom of the professional man is found in a book on confession of the year 1090. Now, if I say 1090, that's the Battle of Hastings, of, by and large, 1066 and all that. And you certainly think that this is very barbaric. But of course, these people were much more delightful people than you are, because they believed in God. And they believed in their own miraculous freedom. And you know what this father confessor said? If a man comes before you with his sin, the only way in which you will be able to cope with it is that you say to yourself, I could have done this too. I could have done this too. That is the thing, the incarnation, gentlemen, which can never be proven by argument. Nobody can force any man, when he hears something, to say, I could have done this too. You see? By logic, by reason, you cannot force any man who takes this very distasteful step to say, I could have done this too. And that's what Anselm meant when he said, everything can be proven except the incarnation. Because the incarnation is the spirit that gets hold of a soul, and he says, I have solidarity with all the sinners. That's what we mean when we say that Jesus came into the world to redeem the sinners, not the heirs. That he thought he might have done it too. Very simple. You always look at so far away, gentlemen. The things of life are terribly simple, very modest, very humble. And it is enough that you say, if a man comes weeping or repenting to you, to yourself, I might have done it too, that you suddenly know that you are in God's place in this very moment. Because you have said this, you are also able to make him say, I would like to be like you, because after all, you haven't done it. You only say, I might have done it. So at this very moment, as soon as you say, I might have done it, he also takes heart and says, well, I have a part in this man to whom I'm speaking at this moment. And he can help me to get out of the water, because he's on the mainland at this moment. Next time it may be the other way, but at this moment at least, you see, he is on drier ground than I. Now the third point, gentlemen. We now move into a new era. Because man has to be told that he is not a thing. He has to be told that he is not a thing. So there are two things which are in this social science of importance. And what is there in any social science which would be different from natural science and from the medieval, so the scholastic side of it? Do you know what that is? Gentlemen, what have we not been able to do after two world wars? We have not been able to do what? To conclude?
Peace.
Peace must be spoken, said, written, it must be spoken. By nature, man is not at peace. Peace is an experience, however, which you must have made before you can understand any movement in society. Because if you are indifferent to the experience of peace, you will make for war. Like this division of 38th degree of latitude for Korea. People who have no idea what it means to have a nation at peace can do certain things. Take a knife and just cut in between and upset the peace for the next 4, 9 years. Gentlemen, I would suggest that we have now three things that cannot be proved by argument. Incarnation, because it means that you feel the absolute solidarity with the whole human race, including Jesus and including the last sinner. And your utter inability to understand anything of the Creator unless all men are created by Him. Oh, the second thing is that you cannot understand anything in nature unless you know what movement is. How you or yourself are inclined to fall down by gravity or to climb up by enthusiasm. Movement cannot be proven. And now the third tenet, which our poor modern natural sociologists do not know yet, why they lead the world astray, the Marxians with their class war, the Paretos with their debunking and their cynicism, is that the condition under which you can make sense in society is that you know what peace is, as against war or strife or jealousy, which is the greatest warfare in humanity, as you know, between women and men. This country is pest-ridden by jealousy. All the girls here in this country think they can't be jealous against any influence on their men. And that's why you have so much divorce. If there's a spark in this man left, he must upset the apricot, because the woman does not include into his being that what he says to other people. She wants to have him as sheer nature. And she burns up with jealousy. I have the most, a dozen of cases in my life who nearly destroyed our own household and our own life because our best friends were just torn away from us by these little women who thought because I was their teacher or their friend, they had to turn against us. They wanted to have the husband all to themselves as like a piece of flesh, like a commodity, like a thing who had no, didn't bathe and didn't hang in these tremendous networks of human speech that goes through the centuries. They were proud that through me this man was connected with history or with Europe or with Christianity. Oh no, that was too dangerous. They couldn't look into this. So they took the knife of jealousy, and said, I own it for better or worse? So they owned it for worse. Gentlemen, this is all the result when you think of your husband and yourself as selves, as individuals, as nature, as just earth. That's what you think. So you think you can have it. You cannot. Nobody can have any other person because he cannot even have himself. As soon as you try to have yourself, you don't have anything except earth, or nerves, or psychosis, or something. That you can have. You can always have something that is below humanity when you try to have it. Then you are obsessed. And this whole country is obsessed by jealousy. The Europeans are obsessed by hatred. Most countries have their obsession. The Russians are obviously obsessed by fear because they have been invaded so often. And on it goes. And these obsessions, gentlemen, ignore the experience of peace. Because if you know what peace is, you know that peace can only come to the free, where every part is moving under its own steam into a harmony
when you are not eating up your husband or your wife by incorporating him like the cannibals for sheer love. That isn't love, that's simian. The apes, they would like to obviously to eat their children or their wife. We cannot. Peace is, gentlemen, a wonderful recognition of the creature-like character of that him whom we love, or her whom we love. That is, that long before we love, she already has received a mission, a way of life, in our own rhythm, and with our own goals. And you have to discover. Peace is the discovery of our specific character. This is quite unexpected to you. And this discovery, gentlemen, has to be completed by telling each other. All natural things exist without their being told. A machine is a machine. But gentlemen, you only love when you finally tell the person that you love. Love is rounded out in the moment that you say so. And peace depends on this potency of a situation to become vocal. The affairs of mankind have to be voiced. And once the life becomes vocal, it can attain peace. So the relation, gentlemen, of life and peace is that life without an organ of vocality, of being voiced, of eloquence, of becoming articulate, is not life at its highest. The highest life, gentlemen, is the articulate life. And the articulation is a process in the life itself. Here I stand as a pure creature, and yet, by the tremendous challenge of the ages, I have become a mouthpiece of the spirit without which you cannot make peace with your ancestors. And this is the history of the mind in the past. I have to tell you. You think I don't have to tell you. You say history is but can be dismissed, forgotten. It cannot. As long as you do not know that long before there was an academic world of laboratories and plumbers, that there has been the medieval university, gentlemen, you have no way, as an alumnus at Dartmouth College, as a member of a board of education, as a father in your family, as a teacher in a school, as a judge in a court, as a businessman in the Chamber of Commerce, to know that natural science isn't the thing for human beings, for example. And to say, Korea cannot be treated by geometry, by longitudes and latitudes, and men cannot be treated by statistics. And men must have the right to change. And at this moment, gentlemen, if Mr. Oppenheimer is since condemned, I do not know what's going to happen. Has there been in the papers already? Your right for a biography is abolished. Because every one of you will say, well, 20 years from now they may hold it against me. And at this very moment you will stop living, and this will be true. But this man said, why are most Americans dead by 25? Because they are afraid that in business the boss may say, what did you do 20 years ago, Mr.? That is, we learn in little doses. You know, man lives by vaccination. That is, if we all had to go through all the diseases totally, we'd all be dead. That we are all immunized in little fractions. If you beat up your brother, you know quite a bit about war. Now, if you had to shoot him, and he had to shoot you, obviously, like Cain and Abel, you know, in this story, there wouldn't be much to learn, because you would both be the weak victims of the experience of war. Now, I think that's the only answer in human history that is really stringent, you see, that we learn in fractions. That If you look into the chalice of a flower and see the morning dew on it, you know all about beauty, you know all about painting, you know all about art, you know all about miracles. There is to learn. There is nothing more complex and more rewarding and more rich than the chalice of one flower in the morning dew. It's enough. If you can learn at all, you learn everything there, you see. The rest is so much greater. But this you have to, some such specific thing. So you have to beat up your brother, I suppose, you see. And often an asylum in which the boys would not be allowed to beat each other or would be a poor education, you see. Because then they would have to wait until they have pistols, you see. And then they would shoot each other. Is this a satisfactory answer?
Well, I believe that one time the soldiers of the last war would be the, well, our hope of speaking in the future, but 15 years after the war.
I'm inclined to think, if only this damn pacifism in this country would not sterilize these experiences. You see, the pacifist is ashamed of having fought against his convictions. So he has been dead in the army, and he will not utilize this tremendous experience. So that's my great fear. In 1960, you are quite right, we may see a great, you see, surge of real understanding of life in this country, because then 15 years, a half generation will have passed from the time in which the soldiers went to war or came home. It usually takes that long. But you have to shake yourself free from this blight of, by your living on principles and on abstract ideas, that a certain events in your life can be excised and don't have to be digested. That's my great fear, you see. That you say, this wasn't me, I was just in a uniform. Now, gentlemen, we have now the big premise of the social sciences. That which is an attempt to prove by reasonable conclusions all the processes in society except the experience of peace. The experience of peace has to be made. Hitler never had the experience of peace, so he could never make peace. And the only thing he could do was war and murder. If you read Hitler's story, that is just what he was completely missing. Any experience of peace. He never had. Now, peace is a very complicated experience, you may say, but there is one minimum in the peace experience. That an event is only fully ripe and complete when it is articulate. So, in the word pax, which comes from hence has to do with pacts. You always have formulation. And you know that the Babylonian captivity in which you live, or positive science, pokes fun at formulations. They say that's formulas. And it pokes fun at words. And it pokes fun at speech. And this whole school today which you have as the apes of humanity, the symbolic logicians and the semanticists and all these people, they try to tell you that you can strip man of his, this electric field in which we are when we speak and are spoken to. And they want to reduce you to people who analyze this network without admitting that while analyzing it, they still speak. If Mr. Lipsis, the symbolic logician, had his way, he would say, I am not speaking while I'm speaking about speaking. That's his formula. You can take it down, gentlemen. It's quite a useful formula. The modern logician tries to say that he is speaking about speaking without speaking himself. That's all nonsense, gentlemen. Put it now in another way. In the incarnation in which you have lost any confidence, somebody tells you what to do. You have a conscience. That is, you hear what this hyperanalyst calls the superego, but
it is better to call it just the person who has the power to say I. For example, medicine tells the doctor, I tell you now to operate. And he has to obey, because that is at this moment, as we said, the state of affairs. And he has to do it, or he forfeits his privilege of being, you see, a member of the medical profession. He has to operate what the indications are according to the modern status of science, such and such. And therefore, gentlemen, all the medieval sciences deal with the great egos, the voices who have the right to say I. All the natural sciences speak of things, of it. You can always catch a natural scientist when he speaks of God as the divine. That's it. Any scientist will say, oh yes, there's something divine, something divine. But you bark when you say there is somebody who speaks, says to you, but I can. Then he says, that's not true. Because in my frame of reference, I'm only dealing with it. I'm only dealing with Newton. So, gentlemen, the natural science has to do with all neutralized things, with Newton, with it. For example, I just wrote an essay, What is Man? You find this in many books today. Of course, anybody who asks what is man can never get a satisfactory answer, because if he is what, then he isn't it. So he's a thing. So it's all prejudice. If once you ask what is man, the answer must always be he is a thing of nature. Because the word what predicates the answer that. And that is the third person neuter. So once you ask the wrong question, gentlemen, you will always end such a poor analyzed it in a gas chamber, or in an oven, or in a prison, or in a cell. And seers cannot be proven, poets cannot be proven. You are men. If you were normal, you would sit quiet, and we would give you so many vitamins and calories, and we would take care of you, and you would get a job, and you would be what man is meant to be. A man well organized, as you are told, well adjusted. And so this poor adjusted person, you see, says, well, I thought I might be a poet, a seer, a child of God. But they tell me that's all nonsense, because they say, what is man? And the answer is all the time, he's it. He is something without speech. And God can't tell him anything that's decided beforehand, and I can't tell mankind anything, because they don't allow me this. You see? They say, be quiet. Behave. I'll give you a refrigerator, and I'll give you an electric railroad, and why aren't you happy? So the pursuit of happiness for others, gentlemen, is a wonderful thing, because it makes this man into a thing. Now the third person, the last situation, however, when you come to this person who can make peace, is that he experiences the following fact, that the order in which we live is that we first must be called by somebody new. Somebody must say to us, Johnny, go to school. Then we hear what we should say in the name of all and law, for example, if your right is what the oldest sets up and said, be quiet. I tell you that this is not a class, because he's another authority, the senior in the class. And he has a divine right of kings or of magistrates, of authority. And the third thing is that then you and he together can debate the it. And you can have a class on some topic. So, gentlemen, the real experience of mankind is discovered only at the end of the human story, it seems. You and I must know what you and I is before we know what it is. This is the sequence, gentlemen, of experience in any real life. Therefore, you can never ask, what is man? Because man is he who has been spoken to as you, and you have spoken to others with authority as I, or in the name of I in the name here of truth, or in the name of philosophy, and now we can debate ourselves in as far as we have dead matter.
And I can see if I have five toes, you have five toes, so with regard to our five toes, nothing can be done except to wait till we get there. But that isn't we, the five toes or the five fingers, that's just the part of us that is it. Will you take this down without understanding it now, gentlemen? I can't help you, we have to compress this, but you understand later. The error of the natural sciences, that they think that you can experience the character of an it without having first experienced peace and before having experienced solidarity. Or God. Or you can formulate the other way. Things are not accessible to people who are not at peace with themselves and with the rest of mankind. The realm of nature is only accessible to scientists. These are people who are without fear, without greed, without jealousy, who know what the truth is, and are perfectly free to go against their own prejudices, who are at peace with themselves, and who follow the voice of their conscience and of the divine spirit. That is the condition of all science, is the belief that peace and incarnation are events that have already prepared the scientist to do his share. Anybody who speaks of steam or electricity or wood presupposes, gentlemen, that he has been met as a second person by somebody who has loved him and taken him up, and that he himself is able to love others for the sake of the truth, he's going to tell them the truth. And for the sake of love, he's going to help them. And for the sake of hope, he is going to go beyond what they and he at this moment know or do. Unless he is in such a position, he knows nothing about steam or electricity or granite or uranium or anything. It is this strange oversight of yours, gentlemen, that you think science, matter of nature, is here first, and the rest can follow. But you put the cart before the horse. The wide world outside of the stars and the moon and the fog and the air of the elements is the third layer into which we can only delve after we have lived together as brothers and our guidance and knowing our direction where we should go. So, gentlemen, it is only to be had any clarity about the things we can know after we have formed a peaceful group, and after this peaceful group has been filled with orientation and direction. Formerly that was called revelation. If you move in vicious circles, you can study everything and won't help you. You must know where you're going. And that you cannot know by looking at the thing, because you must select the things according to the direction in which you want to go. So, gentlemen, from the first title of the scientific work of the unified mankind, from the doctor's degrees of the Middle Ages, and from the liberal arts college and university of the Middle Ages, we have received direction. From the social body, which we now turn to in despair because it's vanishing fast from our families and our communities and our nations, we have received peace. And from our natural cycle, from our laboratories and our workshops and our factories, we have received mastership over the dead things, over that matter. That's very beautiful, this order. But once you turn this order and say, first I must know the things, and then I know myself, and finally I know God, you break down this order, and that's why we are in with this cobalt bomb, or hydrogen bomb, or atom bomb at this moment. Because if you remain in this one cycle, in separation from the two other cycles, you have neither direction nor any peace. The natural scientist in himself must create eternal war. Eternal war, eternal movement, perpetual revolution, the Romans call it. It's a consequence of his attitude. If you ask, what is man? He is the corpse. That must be the answer, because only because we are at the we have the quality of being it. Inasmuch as we are not corpses, gentlemen, you have to ask, who is man? Who is who? And once you ask who is who, that's a different question. You get a different answer. Because who is indispensable, irreplaceable, has a name, speaks to you, demands some of you to act differently from your colleagues and your stupidities. He's an authority. That's why you ask, who is man? Every man is an authority with regard to all other men. You don't know who is heads or two words, the best word. Anybody, you can get up and tell me off, so tell me off here. Just try. Since, gentlemen, we have made quite a discovery. There is an order in this cycle of the sciences, and because the natural science have overstepped their mark and have tried even as the laity as it, we now have to point out that we, as well as all the scientists, have experiences of which the natural sciences do not know. We have direction, and we have peace. The first cycle, then, to put it in form of a slogan, deals with eternity. The second cycle deals with space, and the third cycle deals with time, with temporal orders of society. Again, you cannot quite look through this, but you understand what must happen to amend humanity, in which Mr. Einstein was allowed to state that time was the fourth dimension of space. In that moment, we had two world wars, because that's the end of the world. That meant that the time of the scientist was packed away into the refrigerator of things. Now, do you think that this time between Mr. Newton and Mr. Einstein is a fourth dimension of space? That Mr. Einstein, who quotes Mr. Newton and says he is a very respectable ancestor of mine, is not contained in a living body of time, in a womb of time, pregnant with new things, with creative things? You see, if time is a fourth dimension of space, then nothing new can ever happen. But if time is the element by which we experience peace, then it is the womb out of which something new is created, is born, as you hope from your children. And a woman who is pregnant with child does not think, or if she does so, she is crazy, that it is just a combination of genes in her womb between male and female that will produce this child. If something much greater takes place, life is created there. And that depends on time and hour and constellation and very little to do with Mr. Mendel. Because you very well know that the soul of your child depends on the love you have for each other and not on the genes and the blue eyes or the green feet you have. I would nearly have said the green keys. It is scandalous. It's ridiculous. But that's what you believe, gentlemen. The era of the natural science comes to an end because human time, which is creative of something that has never existed before, has been made into a particle of space. In space, nothing new can ever happen. What's inside space, that's there. And the rest is addition. But gentlemen, I have never existed before, I assure you this. And as far as you have existed before, you should not exist now. Change. And you can change under the impact of my son. Because the living world is created. And people have changed through the ages because somebody has told them to change. That's not chemistry. And that's not physics. And that's not nature. Because nature is reality without speech. But I can integrate a feeble-minded city boy here and call him, I have done this. Just because by calling upon his name, he suddenly got himself together and became a different person. The word, gentlemen, connects you with parts of the universe of whose existence you had no idea before. And in the very moment that you realize that because you are of Polish descent, you have now the great honor of renewing the spirit of peace which ensouled the Polish nation in the 16th century, when it was the great nation of pacification in Europe, this man can suddenly have a mission in Babylon. That is, speech connects the most unheard parts of the universe with other parts of the universe, which physically have nothing in common. I can leap over thousands of years, by the way, and you suddenly can get strength. And what has been your weakness, that you were of Polish ancestry, now suddenly becomes your strength. That's why God is powerful in the weak. Because the word suddenly makes people draw on resources that physically, in nature, are not available. Because they are so far away in time and space. Don't you know that? Everybody knows it. But nobody wants to know it. The word is creative because it defines the neighborhood in space. So, gentlemen, the society is that order of mankind in which we can make peace by drawing on all the resources that are not in space, that are not here tangible, that are not on the scales, and that are not in the stores. In as far as we must eat, we must go to stores and get the wheat. And in the fire, you must drive a car, we must have gasoline. But with regard to your own future, you cannot go by the gasoline and you cannot go by the wheat. They don't tell you anything. For what purpose you should eat and in what direction you should drive your car, that's not in the gasoline and that's not in the wheat. Let me give you one story to illuminate in what danger you are at this moment. A friend of mine in Wisconsin used to drive over Sunday, and he had a foreman, and they had these cars in the 20s of the century, and was quite new, Ford cars, and they always competed in the distance they made over Sunday. One went 600 miles, the other went 700 miles, you see. And then they asked each other where they had been, and they didn't know. They had just gone one 600 miles, the other had gone 700 miles. And that's by and large what our men at this moment. Because he believes that he lives by things. And he doesn't believe that he lives by the word. If you live by the word, you would have to go to a certain place. But this foreman used to tell my friend when he asked him in despair, he was a European, this friend, but where did you go? He said, well, we took gas at such and such a place. We took gas at such and such a place. So even the place name was subordinated to the filling station, to the place where you got gas for your machine. It had no meaning. It had no meaning. Nature is reality stripped of names. When you say that Paris is a filling station for your car while you're touring France, you see, you are treating France as nature. When, however, you take gas in order to go to Paris, then you are a reasonable human being because you know where you're going. And this is today always very delicate, the balance. Most of you can be tempted all the time to treat Paris as a filling station. In this very moment you are in nature and you have lost direction. So the social scientists, gentlemen, come to rescue the layman from his treatment as an object. And the one thing you have to fight is that people should treat you objectively. They dishonor you if you do that. That's, you don't believe that. You want to be treated objectively. And that's, today is a dividing line between the people who will come get into the future and the people who will not make the future. And whenever this is denied, that it isn't the highest to be treated objectively, Whatever this is denied, takes it as my last word to you, gentlemen. You move in the Babylonian captivity of the universe of science. Anybody who believes that the academic cycle is self-sufficient and doesn't hinge, isn't suspended within the two other, destroys peace and destroys authority and direction, because authority is direction. And in destroying a direction and peace, he lowers men below the animals.